From Fargo, North Dakota, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 13th day of April, 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half-hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets and what's happened all week long with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll check in on the agricultural news, and we'll hear also from Eric Snodgrass. He'll tell us about that great big storm that's making its way across the middle part of South Dakota, parts of Minnesota, how much snow it will dump, and then maybe how long that might take to melt. It'll delay their growing season for another week or so, I would think. We'll check in with Eric about that, and we'll do it all right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Friday afternoon. Mike Zuzulo is here now. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Mike, you and I are straddling that great big storm. I think you're south of it mostly, and here I am in Fargo and north of it. I'm glad I don't think either of us are going to get too much of a problem out of it to begin with.
No, and I think that's a great way to start this show off, Todd, because on the Kansas-Oklahoma border, where the heart of the drought monitor showed the worst drought in this week's update on Wednesday, it's going to be, in terms of the updated midday model maps, about 26 degrees for a low on Monday. That's going to last for greater than 6 hours. There's another morning in the next 72 hours that we will probably drop to those levels, if not colder. And then on the Kansas-Oklahoma border, after a low of 26 on Monday, the models are suggesting a high of back to 92 on Tuesday. I think by giving you this example of the extreme weather that we're straddling, like you say, this week's market between the four-week highs in the soybeans and back to being in the three-week range and the lower end of the range of the last 3 weeks for the hard red wheat, I think we clearly have demonstrated in the trade to price more of the USDA report in versus anything else like good trade news that we've had.
Well, indeed, we've had good trade news. The president is talking about wanting to open up discussions, possibly joining the TPP. This after last week, we had real difficulties with China. And then earlier in this week, President Xi there being, I don't know whether I want to call it conciliatory, but at least looking like China would be more in line with the intellectual property thinking of the United States. All kind of good news. What impact does it have on the marketplace?
Well, I think it is probably going to be an impact that is longer term, which that doesn't bother me. And I would say you're exactly right about the TPP. And that came on the heels of going back to the Farm Belt states and talking to people in Iowa, talking to the Nebraska senator, talking to our senator here, Pat Roberts. I think President Trump going back to the base, back to the agriculture base in particular, in terms of this new rhetoric and his new thoughts. And, you know, we also heard that maybe we can look forward to an E15 mandate for summer gasoline blends. This brings back the idea that he is more like Teddy Roosevelt. He's a populist president who appreciates his base. And he realizes, I think, in the November midterm elections, he needs that base. And that was something that I had assumed this winter after doing research on him and comparing him to Teddy Roosevelt. Had gotten shaky on that with some of the last 3 months talk and Twitter feed things that he had talked about. But it seems like he's squarely back, at least at this point, in favor of the agriculture base. And so between that and the World Trade Organization putting out some very strong merchandise trade numbers, the best trade numbers, I would say, in the last 10 years since the financial crisis, I think you still have now the potential, the increasing potential that commodity investors will come back into the commodities and look at that as a good diversification because inflation is back. And if the Fed steadily raises interest rates and we don't have any trade barriers put up, that would be, I think, a good way to diversify your holdings if you are an investor, whether it's an institutional investor or a private wealth investor. So I think it's good in the medium term. I think in the short term, we still have to deal with the funds who play the supply demand very heavily, play the weather very heavily, and the USDA report was not kind to the wheat and that really took over trade after Wednesday.
You mentioned the lows in the wheat market, the four-week highs in the soybeans. Are these highs and lows for the near term, in your opinion, or do we have more movement on one or the other or both of them to move?
Yeah, that's a great question. In the soybeans especially, I'm right around 70% of insured bushels sold with clients, and I'll be locked and loaded to get more 18 soybeans hedged as early as next week. I was hoping we would go through the March highs in the soybeans led by the meal. I think the charts would suggest that's still possible. I think the cash markets and the world soy meal prices, especially Rotterdam and the meal price in China, which has both have gone back up to their old highs, if not made new highs, would strongly suggest this is likely to get back to those March highs. But I think the effects of those higher prices in the longer run and the level they've been at for this long is indicative of some demand rationing. I think also USDA's bean production for Brazil on the report of 115 million tons was a gift to the bean bulls. And I think it's at least 117. That 2 million tons doesn't seem like much, but in a year like this, I think it could mean a lot. And then you throw on top of that, the next report is that all-important May report where we get 18-19 supply-demand numbers. I think we've got to assume, as hedgers, that bean acres are going to be going up, especially with this current weather pattern. So I think we really need to be very, very eager on rallies, especially to get up towards 100% of insured bushels on 18 beans and lock in these tremendous profits. And I know it could go higher, Todd, but I just have to lock down one side, so to speak, so that both sides don't blow away.
Do you think if you're going to expect to see an acreage number that gets larger for soybeans in May, that the corn carryout for the 2018-19 crop will come down, and how low?
I do think it will come down, especially if this weather pattern continues to be wet and cold east of the Mississippi River, mainly because, yes, you'll probably see a more conservative USDA in terms of wanting to raise corn acreage numbers in futures reports. But more importantly, I think the national yield will not be those top-end numbers that the trade has probably been factoring in because of what we've been able to do the last 3 years. So I think the idea of getting below a 2 billion bushel carryover is in the trade right now, but not much below it. And that's why we haven't been able to get up to that 425 level, along with the fact that the corn is still attached to the hip of the wheat market. To answer your question, I think we could go into the 1.8 billion bushel carryover level on both lower national yield and an increase in exports, because we are becoming more and more a more dominant force in the exports throughout the marketing year. And unless wheat comes in and competes against us more effectively as a feed grain, which it is doing in Europe right now, I think our exports are going higher in the corn. So a 1.8 carryover, I think, is a number we could shoot towards in terms of pricing into these futures. And that would probably equate to about a 435 futures price in December.
Hey, you have a great weekend, Michael.
Thank you, sir.
And of course, is Mike Zuzulo. He is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. In today's agricultural news, now that House Agriculture Chairman Mike Conaway has finally gone live with the House Farm Bill, the central question is whether the Texas Republican can rally 218 votes that are needed to get the bill passed in the lower chamber. The answer to that question will depend heavily, of course, on the political gamesmanship surrounding Conaway's plan to impose stricter work requirements on millions of low-income Americans who receive food stamps. As expected, the $865 billion legislation would overhaul the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, otherwise known as SNAP, by proposing more stringent work requirements for between 5 and 7 million recipients and by creating a much larger pool of money for states to grow SNAP working training programs, what Conaway calls a springboard out of poverty. Conaway, who is planning to hold a markup next Wednesday, says he's eternally optimistic about the measure's political chances and argued that it doesn't matter how he gets to 218. House Speaker Paul Ryan threw his support behind the bill and said he thinks the House can pass it. On the other hand, Democrats are strongly opposed. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi called the bill a betrayal of rural communities and working families, which does not bode well for efforts to preserve the Farm Bill as one of the last vestiges of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill. Aside from Democrats, the other group to watch is the Freedom Caucus, which has yet to issue its evaluation of the measure. Well, let's stay in Washington, D.C. We'll recap some of the other news. This from the White House yesterday. During a meeting with farm state lawmakers, President Donald Trump said he has directed his trade team to look into rejoining the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Meeting with senators and other leaders from the Midwest, President Trump heard about troubles his trade policy is posing in agriculture and the benefits of TPP to farmers and ranchers. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who attended the meeting, says rejoining TPP is the best thing the U.S. can do to push back against China. Covering all products grown in the United States at the time of negotiation, TPP was estimated to add $4.4 billion to cash receipts for farmers and ranchers. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa says the meeting was to stress the importance of increasing market access to protect farmers. Farm groups say farmers would rather trade than take subsidies to be profitable, in referring to the trade dispute with China and the proposed tariffs as a result. President Trump has promised to support farmers through the trade war, which many speculate would come from the Commodity Credit Corporation. Speaking of Mr. Trump, the administration is apparently planning to allow E15 sales year-round as well. During the White House Ag Roundtable yesterday, Trump announced his support for E15 sales year-round with a cap on RIN prices, according to attendee Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. President Trump told the group, "We're going to raise it up to 15%, adding the move makes a lot of people happy. Growth Energy applauded the comments from Trump, calling the move a common-sense fix. And finally today, scientists say a climate boundary separating the eastern and western parts of the United States, discovered more than 100 years ago, has shifted 140 miles to the east. In a report published by Columbia University, scientists say global warming has pushed the boundary east and could have significant implications on farming in the region. Scientists say that due to global-scale wind patterns, the west of the boundary rainfall drops off sharply. East of the line, rainfall picks up sharply. The boundary was first discovered in the late 1800s along with the 100th meridian and has moved closer to the 98th meridian to cut through east central Texas along the western borders of Arkansas, Missouri, and Iowa before shifting northwest through North Dakota. The boundary divide will continue to move eastward due to global warming. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Friday afternoon. Eric Snodgrass is now here from Agrible. Hey, Eric, thanks for being with us. I take it that you were supposed to be in the midst of this blizzard there in South Dakota, but weren't able to make it out. That seems like it's a pretty good decision.
I am so glad I'm sitting in my office right now, because had I gone to Pierce, South Dakota to give this talk this morning, I would not be getting home until probably Sunday, even though I had a flight supposed to take me home tonight. So yeah, I'm glad I'm sitting here watching it from afar. But you know, this is really important for us in ag, because basically we're not only bringing in some really cold air into the Dakotas, but we're also bringing in a lot of snow. I think some parts of South Dakota through parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin are going to see well over a foot of snow out of this system. And so just think about it. You know, here we are getting toward the middle part of April. We're going to put a bunch of snow on the ground. We're going to have the next 4 or 5 days be colder than average across that part of the country. So we're talking about a continuation of any sort of, you know, delay they've already had in planting there, just continuing. And, you know, around here, what are we going to get? Well, we've already got storms firing to the south of us here in central Illinois earlier today. And this is just, it's this big low pressure system kind of wraps itself up. We're going to be seeing mainly our biggest severe weather threat to our south and west. I'm talking about getting into Missouri, Kansas, maybe southern Iowa, but certainly getting down into Arkansas, eastern Texas, Louisiana, the whole lower Mississippi River Valley. So big, nasty squalling. A storm's going to go racing through there in the overnight hours. For us here in central Illinois, expect storms tonight. Expect quite a bit of shower and thunderstorm activity tonight into early tomorrow morning. So the problem is that after the system goes through, you know, the trough that's creating is very deep, and it's going to be really dropping our temperatures off at least through the start of next week, so Monday, Tuesday timeframe. So yeah, this is a big one, and it's, as it comes through, it's going to cause a lot of problems, and just, you know, it's going to steal from us another potential 4, 5, 6 days of field work. So yeah, watching it carefully.
Is it big enough to break up anything that we've had in place to help us get into a more normal pattern for the April month timeframe?
Absolutely, and this is the best news I could give any farmer that's listening to this broadcast right now, and that is, we have been plagued since February by this deep, persistent trough sitting over the Hudson Bay. And that's allowed for just cold air to keep sneaking out of Western Canada, comes through the Dakotas, goes right here across Illinois and into the Eastern Corn Belt. Well, the good news is that we have seen a pretty substantial pattern shift that's gotten rid. It's gotten rid of that trough. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that our temperature pattern and precipitation patterns can be very characteristic of spring now. What I mean by that is, well, I would have expected to see this pattern setting up mid-March and lasting through, you know, middle of April, maybe toward the end of April. And instead, we're just now getting it. So that means we're going to get up, down kind of nature in our temperature pattern because the jet stream is loaded up with troughs all across the Pacific. But here's the good news. They're moving. They're transitory. They're coming through, which means we're going to get cold this weekend as this first trough goes through. But we're going to expect a nice sort of rebound in temperatures midweek next week. So we're going to go back up to feeling warm again. But we have repeated system kind of after repeated system coming through. I would have loved to have seen this a month ago, not right now. But the good news is this will mean that we will start to see our soil temperatures come back up. This will mean that we will be getting those planting windows starting to arrive. And, you know, my daily forecasts are going to help folks kind of pick out where and when they're going to be able to do that. But I will say this, with this active pattern, I'm watching for this one feature that looks like it's coming maybe around the 19th, 20th, 21st, somewhere in that time frame of April, where we're going to be putting a what we call a cutoff low over the central states. And why this is substantial is if it sets up where the models currently have it projected, and there's been some good consistency in the models over this, this is a cutoff low over Kansas. And if that happens, that will be bringing in precipitation to the Kansas wheat. And we know that Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas are still struggling with drought. So this would be huge for not only wheat quality, but wheat yields in Kansas. So all eyes are on this system coming through around the 20th, 21st to see if it actually materializes. So we'll have to wait and see, but certainly some decent model agreement here at this point.
Do we have any data at this point to look further out into the growing season for the summer months to give us a suggestion of what might be in store for us?
Yeah, you know, we always look to the beginning of the month to get our longer range forecast guidance up and going. So, you know, we can look at a lot of different sources. I'll compare for us kind of today two of the big groups of models. We have what's called the NMME. It's 8 global models, 6 are running in the U.S., 2 are running in Canada. And right now, they've been pretty consistent with trying to keep the heat and the dryness in the Central Plains or keeping it west of the Central Plains, so kind of in the Intermountain West and along the West Coast and Pacific Northwest. So that's where they're keeping all the heat, June, July, August. They do have Illinois warmer than average for June, July, August, but nothing like a huge deviation from normal. And that's actually right now in pretty sharp contrast with the long-range European model, which was just updated on the 11th. And what we've got there is the European model is trying to bring in some heat in the Central Plains, but they want to bring in dryness for Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, you know, that kind of area for, you know, for July. And, you know, while that could be a bit of a scary forecast, remember, if we have decent soil moisture going into July and most of the heat stays west, we can be a little bit drier than average in July and still do really well in our corn yields. But it's an inconsistency between the models I'm going to be watching carefully. My analog technique, that's the third one I'm going to use, does keep most of the heat and dryness in the plains, does keep Illinois warmer than average for June, July, August, but does not bring in major precipitation deviations at this point. So this could spell a little bit of adversity. Does it make me think we're going to have like a 160 crop? Not even a chance. But it certainly is something that we'll be watching very carefully over the coming months.
Okay, and we'll be asking you about it. Thanks so much, Eric.
Yep, thank you.
That, of course, is Eric Snodgrass. He is with Agrible. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.